This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and welcome to another month of Boo. Here we are, beginning our October with more scary stuff. Well, not exactly scary, but something that's going to be in the vein of, if you get my pun, something rather macabre, or at least unusual and somewhat different than what is considered typical bubblegum-for-the-eyes type magic. This month, we're going to be focusing on episodes featuring people talking about seances and haunted stuff, and also wrapping up with Houdini, since he had died back in 1926 on Halloween. All of the people you're going to get to hear this month are a lot of fun people that you will enjoy and learn from as well. So they will be entertaining, educational, and enlightening. What a great conversation you're going to enjoy this week with Eric Dittleman. While we were in Las Vegas for Magic Live, we had a chance to finally sit down and chat. This was a long overdue meeting, and this was something that I think you will enjoy on many different levels. Whether you are a mind reader or mentalist or not, I know that you will enjoy a lot of the wisdom he has to share with us here. Merrick doesn't give lectures to magicians nor appear at magic conventions where he's going to be lecturing. If he has, I don't know where it has been. I haven't seen him doing that because he's out actually working in the trenches for real folks for real money. Anyhow, this is more or less kind of like a lecture from the standpoint he just drops a lot of wisdom on us. There are so many different things that he talks about from his career and from his experiences that I know you will learn from and not only be educated, but you'll be entertained. He is just a very fun and funny guy and friendly, and you can hear everything he says is with tongue-in-cheek in a way and with a jolly little laugh. So he's really enjoying our conversation and sharing the ideas that you'll hear here this week. Some of you may know the name of Eric Dittleman as being one of the people who had been on America's Got Talent. He was the first mentalist, I believe, actually, who had gone as far as he did. And so he was breaking new ground at the time. And since then, others have followed. He also had a podcast with Matt Franco for a long time called Mind Over Magic, and I've got a link to that on this week's episode on the MagicWordPodcast.com, where you can go and hear some or all of those episodes. I listened to every one of the podcasts. He and Matt Franco were great together. Anyhow, I'm going to shut up and let you listen to the conversation to hear what he has to say. So please welcome my guest and my friend, Mr. Eric Dittleman, here on The Magic Word. The conversation today is one that, like many of the podcasts, it seems like episodes I've had here of late, have been ones that I have been wanting to do for a long time, but our schedules just haven't matched up where we've been able to get together and do it. And so we happen to be actually here in Las Vegas at Magic Live, and I finally got to catch up with Eric Dittleman. And Eric is someone who I'm sure that you've known or seen. If you haven't, you've been under a rock, because he was one of the finalists, really went pretty high up on America's Got Talent several years ago, and was one of the first mind readers, I believe, to have gone that far, and also been on The Ellen Show, and Penn & Teller Fool Us, and golly, just a lot of different things, and then as a college entertainer and the college circuit traveling about, and that's just the U.S., and he's been traveling the world then, too. And after he had, I think it was like third place or something that you got on AGT, that you then got all these contracts for like 2 years out or something. So, and again, like whenever I was in New York City, I was out there to see Darren Brown's show. And I thought, well, maybe I can catch up with Eric. And I think we saw each other and you said, man, I'm gone tomorrow. And
yeah,
we'll exactly. I promise we'll get together. So we finally, I'm so glad we did. Eric Dittleman, here you are. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Scott. We finally worked it out.
I mean,
other conventions just in passing. I think we saw each other briefly at FISM and Quebec briefly. But other than that, yeah. It's
well, there's so much going on at these magic conventions, obviously, and so many people, and you want to have an opportunity to visit with everybody and as well. And there are people that you haven't seen in not just a year, but sometimes maybe 3 or 5 years or something, and you really want to get caught up and everything, you know.
Yeah.
But anyhow, like many of us, I haven't followed your career until you actually hit it, I guess.
Sure.
And so you've had a lot of years that you weren't hitting it, you know.
Yeah, pre-AGT, before anyone knew who I
That's
was.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Suddenly,
what was her name? That was one of the judges.
Sharon Osbourne.
Yeah, Sharon Osbourne.
And
she loved
Howard Stern. And this was like over 10 years, 12 years, I think. And yeah, I never expected to get a top 10 finalist. Definitely was kind of the highest I reached, but it was still real fun and career changing. I mean, it put me on the maps.
It definitely did. And I remember that Sharon said, "Are you single?" And you said, "Yes." So, well, I think after this, you'll probably find some women, or something like that.
It's so strange the things they decided to focus on back then. And it's just, it was such a different show than it is now.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the amount of time the eyes get now compared to the 90 seconds I had back in the day.
But, now, when you were, first of all, preparing for that, and Matt Franco had already won prior to you. Is that right?
Opposite way. Later? No, I was on before Matt, so he actually saw and was cheering me on throughout my season, and then 2 years later, he went on, and I got to return the favor and help support him and sit with his family and cheer him on, and then he ended up winning the whole show. And now,
and now you're working with him and kind of helping him a little bit. Is that right?
Yeah, we've stayed friends through all these years. I mean, we started doing the college market together and kind of were figuring that area out. That's where we met. And then, you know, when he had his opportunities, of course, I came out to Vegas to help him kind of launch his show and, you know, sit in the audience and check angles during those first couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, he's just, you know, amazing and is still, you know, as successful as he is 7 years later with his show. So
that's
to
amazing.
See my friends' faces on billboards when I come to Vegas
kind of
is
surreal?
So surreal. And I mean, I'm so proud of them.
Of course.
So, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Were you from Rhode Island originally? That's where you kind of got to know him then?
Massachusetts. So we had the New England blood together.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, but I grew up in central Massachusetts in that area.
And that's, kind of how you got to know him then through that. And then, of course, you were working, I guess, on a comedy circuit. And there really hasn't been a comedy club circuit the way there used to be.
Right.
So I'd say, were you kind of on the tail end of it, do you think?
I just did a lot of the local clubs in Massachusetts. You know, I was just looking for stage time wherever I could. And, you know, I've always had kind of one foot in the comedy world.
Mm-hmm.
I did improv for a long time and stand up. And I was just finding that separately from the magic and eventually mentalism that I ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually combining it all together as one art form and just that became my show. So it's kind of hard to separate the two now from, you know, the magic and the comedy. It's all just one show.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when you got started then, going back, I guess, earlier, I'm always curious about what it was like as far as how you found your footing in the comedy clubs. Were you just doing magic only or some then started adding mentalism and why?
Yeah, I think I got involved in the improv scene like middle school and I was trying to emulate what my brother was doing in high school. He was like the improv team captain. So I wanted to be the improv team captain when I got to high school.
Okay.
So I was just doing that, running the after school club, you know, and it wasn't until college I continued the improv, but I started doing just stand up. So this was all separate. It was just the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, independently, on a different track, I was like, you know, learning sleight of hand. And again, in college is again where one of those pivotal moments where I was like, oh, you know, I'm not much of a card guy or whatever. I want to try and make this transition into mentalism.
Yeah.
I started studying, you know, Bob Cassidy, Banachek.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to meet these heroes of mine. So there was very two separate paths that I was following.
Wow.
And then I just developing those skills independently, but then putting them together because that's who I was, you know, that made sense. So that was kind of showing all facets of what I was doing.
Yeah, you triangulated magic and mentalism with comedy.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure usually people think of themselves as being comedy magicians. In a way, magic is fun and funny and people laugh because they're surprised and everything. And so it's probably a natural transition then to add comedy to mentalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I had been watching mentalism and like the old stereotype type of a lot of mentalists at the time was long, drawn out stories, you know. So my style of like, at least let's make the process entertaining along the way. So I naturally was just including jokes I was writing, you know, for my stand-up act.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I have a bit about this. Why don't I see if I can attach a, you know, an effect to it? And kind of approaching the creative process from that angle rather than what effect do I want to do and let's write the jokes. Let's try it the other way and see what I want to say first.
And see what's going to fit to the comic.
Yeah.
That's a different way of looking at that, certainly. And I know, like, if you compare that, let's say, with Tim Conover, I mean, he used to have a very light kind of a show, but it wasn't as heavy on comedy as what yours is. I mean, you can tell that you have deep comedy roots.
Thank you.
And it's because you're funny, and the way you handle that, the audience is great. And again, when I'm looking at Tim Conover, I used to watch him perform. He would just be energetic on stage, you know, just always up on the balls of his feet, it seems like, and would get the audience involved as well, which is a different kind of a vibe of having people laugh. And with laughter, that is a good direction or misdirection for comedy. But in mentalism, there's really not a lot of sleight of hand as there would be that you need to, for misdirection.
Correct.
So is there something then that you have, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, it was interesting that I was, I think, naturally drawn to the mentalism. I made that shift consciously because I, you know, didn't want to hide behind props or cards or big box illusions or anything. And it was kind of the closest of just walking on stage and being treated like a stand-up, you know, give me a microphone and, you know, a few bits of paper from Staples or whatever, and you essentially have no props. You're just you on stage. So it kind of helped me develop this personality and just being me and not, you know, that trap a lot of, you know, young performers fall into in the magical arts where they want the magic to kind of shape the personality rather than just be you. That's the individual part that we want to focus and shine on, right? Is the uniqueness between my personality, your personality makes us who we are and what makes us, you know, different and more entertaining and engaging performers.
And that's why people would want to book Eric Dittleman or Scott Wells or whatever, because you have, each of us have our own unique personalities. And if we're trying to be a Matt King or Lance Burton or whoever is the person that they would clone that for the day, they're never going to find themselves if they keep chasing after that next person.
Absolutely.
They want to be the next Eric Dittleman. So, oh, he's funny. I like this. But it's a little bit more difficult to try to steal someone's mentalism routine as it is one of their magic tricks.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, then the improv side of things ties in so perfectly, I think, for mentalism, because you do have to be quick on your feet and you have to respond to what people are going to be thinking, and you never know what people are going to be thinking. Right. So to like create little pockets of like almost like a joke bucket where you're setting up the frame and then you're letting the audience kind of play and respond, and whatever their thought is, I, you know, can go and interact with that. And I know that that's going to be like the comedy part in the show. So, yeah.
Wow. So that's really, I like the way that you're thinking about that. And you apply that not only to the stage, but also to close up whenever you're going to be doing some walk around type of mechanism as well.
Yeah, and I've even gotten better at refining what my close-up set is. You know, when I'm not traveling and performing around the country, and when they need me at the show, I'm actually do speakeasy magic in New York as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're sitting in a table with people surrounding you, and they're like right up on top of you. And that show has its own challenges for mentalists, where you're, you know, the lighting might not be ideal, and it's very noisy. And someone whose act is all just talking, you have to find a way to keep everyone engaged, whether they're, you know, had a few drinks or they're trying to see what's happening at another table, just getting everyone to focus back in when so much is happening in that environment. It's a challenge, but it's a welcome one, because I love performing in that show and getting the reactions from people that, you know, don't necessarily get that mentalism wow, you know, in everyday lives, and to kind of break up what all the other performers are doing. That's a lot of sleight of hand, an amazing sleight of hand, but to just sit down and be like, I'm not going to touch a deck of cards. Who's your first crush? Just think of it, and just boom, they go wild. Yeah,
well, that's very direct.
Yeah.
And whereas a card trick is pick a card, do this, count down 20 cards, and then add those three together or whatever. It gets to be kind of a process.
It can be, yeah. And I think there's process, and there needs to be process in mentalism, but it's just finding ways to keep that brief if you can, or keep it entertaining if you can't make it brief. So as long as people are engaged throughout the process, I think that's the key.
And you keep a finger on the pulse to tell if they're engaged or not. And if they're not, do you feel like I need to wrap this up or move faster? Or you cut things?
Well, I'm going to do my time, because we all have to do our set time.
Yeah.
But you use different strategies. So, you know, one approach, you know, when I sit down at a table at something like Speakeasy Magic, rather than just launch into my first effect, I want everyone on my side. So my first effect is really the first couple jokes I tell, so that they get to know my personality. And I can really tell a lot from the table just by their reaction to my opening joke that normally kills, but if for some reason it's not, I know I have to make small adjustments and I maybe have to work harder to pull them in and, you know, maybe call out that elephant in the room is like, yeah. Oh, usually that gets a bitter laugh, but I guess, you know, we'll change gears with you.
Well, I think your opening line we were talking about last night was very funny when you talk about how to spell your name.
Well, everyone spells it wrong. So I know that, you know, as a mentalist, the first thing I should know is how they're going to think about me. So I know they're going to spell Dittleman wrong. It's actually Dittelman. But a lot of people think it's spelled L-E-C, mind reader. Very good. And that usually gets a good laugh. And then I go, yeah, you just forgot that simple childhood spelling rule. L before E, accepted. Jew. Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's how they know to spell my name. And which is good because especially when all my social medias have my name spelled rightly, I want them to find it. So they have to remember that little rhyme for themselves.
Oh, so it has a dual purpose too. Exactly. And branding. Yeah. I love that.
Though I did buy all the domain names. So in case someone types it wrong, they'll still go to my website. They'll find it somewhere. It'll forward it.
Like Disney, D-I-S-N-E-E or something. You know, if the kids are typing it in or whatever, then as well. As far as the comedy, then, so again, you found your comedy roots when you were, I guess, as a child working in improv and everything, but you were doing magic then in high school, I'm assuming, bit then too?
Yeah, it was just learning. I mean, it was very much a hobby at that time, just kind of, you know, playing around with like early magic books and just card tricks, rubber band stuff. But yeah, I think you're in that formative age where you can experiment. You can find different types of magic that you can play around with and see what fits best with you. Sure. So I think I found it later when I switched from, you know, magic into mentalism that just resonated with who I was and my personality. Mm-hmm. So I just continued down that path because I found the most success and it felt the most true for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And as far as the speakeasy, I want to go to that for a minute, and not just there, but also when you're doing close-up, how do you introduce yourself as a mentalist? Because particularly, let's say, a speakeasy where they come to see magic, they don't necessarily come to see mentalism. I was talking to someone today about what it's like in working. Oh, I know. I was talking to my Uber driver about a magician walking up to a table, because a lot of times people don't appreciate a magician that someone's going to do magic. I mean, in other words, if you pay for a ticket to go and see a magic show, you know what's coming. But if you're paying whatever's on the menu and someone comes to your table and says, hi, you want to pick a card or, you know, or did you lose a white knife? How about a red knife? Or whatever it is, you know what I mean? I think it'd be more difficult to walk up and say, hey, can I read your mind? I mean, it's even more mind-blowing. I mean, I would think for people to try to relate to how do you explain yourself and what you are when you go to it?
Yeah, well, the beautiful thing about Speakeasy is the intro of the show is really showcases Todd Robbins' brilliance because he's setting the tone for what that experience is. And it'll tell the audience that you might see, you know, a pickpocket or a card sharp or a mentalist or a mind reader who's there to read your mind. So I'm not approaching the tables cold. I don't think I'm very, very often in a situation where I have to go up to a group of people cold and surprise them that I'm a mind reader because either I'm, you know, doing a corporate banquet where I'm going to be performing on stage later so I can say I'm here hired by the company to meet you and I'll just say I'm, you know, Eric Dittleman, the mind reader. And then they're interested and I'm like, you want to see something now? We'll do something short to kind of break the ice and getting people talking. Because again, you have to know why you're there and why you're booked. And, you know, during cocktail hours for corporate events, it's just to get people interacting with each other. So I want to facilitate that. And whether it's me being Mr. Personality and just telling jokes and then showing them one kind of cool, interesting piece of mind reading, that's one thing. Or then to like set up like, hey, this is a big, you know, event for you and a big treat for you that you're here at a, you know, a sales rewards client appreciation that you get your own stage show with a mind reader later. Let me tell you a little bit what's about to happen. You get to see a sneak preview before, you know, the 30 or 45 minute program. So again, you're not really approaching these cold per se because you're there for a specific reason. Mm-hmm. And then back to Speakeasy, Todd is really setting that ambiance and really setting every performer up for success just the moment the show starts. So
I say, that makes perfect sense. My thought, and you've answered the question there as to like a corporate strolling thing during cocktails when they may not necessarily be expecting it. But then when you're saying, well, I'm going to be performing later, let me do something for you now. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice way of trying to do that. Plus, you can always do a little pre-show.
I guess. I mean, you can take advantage of opportunities. I mean,
by at least learning somebody's name, if nothing else.
Again, I like to have as little stress before I go on stage as possible, so to not worry much about any of that kind of approach to it. But, you know, ideally you can just walk on stage and wow an audience, and, you know, you can just show up without, you know, having to do anything beforehand.
Well, at Speakeasy, I understand that they do kind of have a rotating stable of
so I'm not there all the time. Yeah. Right. So and I'm Alex there Boyce when said, they need me. Yeah. Exactly.
They said, Alex Boyce was saying, well, just call me when you're coming in town. I'll let you know my schedule is.
Yeah.
Or, if I'm in town, I'll come see you, you know, or whatever.
Absolutely.
So I know that you travel a lot. Are most of your things anymore much of the college circuit, or are you doing them more corporate or
both? Yeah. I mean, I think it's just good, especially post the pandemic, diversifying is the name of the game. So, like, you can't necessarily rely on one market as much because, you know, there's things can fluctuate. It could be good now for certain years, and then you might see a dip in certain markets. So, like, to have different options and just to keep working is the goal. And, you know, just to be open to opportunities and find ways to make things work. I mean, when we all made the shift kind of to virtual shows during the pandemic, that was a whole world that we didn't even know existed, but we found a way to make things work. So, you know, I kind of am keeping that mentality as markets shift and different markets have boons, you know, and dips themselves, to find a way to, you know, be like, all right, how do we find a way to make this work and just be flexible and open?
Do you still do some Zoom shows for clients?
Not as much anymore. Well, I mean, it's an option. I mean, they'll give me a price and I'll do one. But
yeah, of course.
I'll never say no. It's just, I'll quote you a number. I'll do it for
but people are anxious to get out of the house and go and see live entertainment, you know, basically.
And especially with comedy, with that side of what I do, you want to be present in the moment, and you're sharing, you know, an experience that they might only happen now. Like, the thing about improv, it's ephemeral. So if you go to see an improv show, that improv show is not going to happen again. It's almost like you treat each scene like tissue paper. When it's done, you toss it up and throw it away.
Right.
It's, you know, we just shared in this moment together. We only have that. So keeping that in the live performance. So I'm always looking for opportunities where someone kind of, you know, you don't want things to go off the rails, but when they do, I'm not scared of that because I know this is a unique experience.
Right.
And sometimes it makes the show more fun, but you just need to know how to approach it and to kind of contain the madness. You don't want it to bomb, obviously, but having the experience of, like, you know, going with the flow and making things work, that's been such a key element that I've learned from improv.
People are starting to learn more what a mentalist is and what mind readers are. I mean, they understand magicians now. As they start to understand our line of entertainment, I think they're starting to expand their minds. So you're still probably meeting a lot of people saying, you do what now?
Yeah, I think it's more recognizable now with, like, you know, there was the old TV show, The Mentalist, that was on. So it's more in the vernacular. You know, I just tell people normally I'm just a mind reader, and people get what that is. But I also tell them I'm an honest mind reader, and I'm, like, not using any supernatural or psychic powers, but it's a combination of magic and psychology. And that's kind of what I use to justify the quote method. And that just, you know, people have thoughts on disclaimers. I just found something that works for me and resonates with me, so that I can not worry about it and I can be myself. And I think that's more important. So whether you want to use a disclaimer or not, you know, is it really going to change someone's mind in the audience? I have no idea, but I just want to make sure that I'm comfortable in my own skin so that I can be the most me I can be.
Well, how do you skirt that issue? What is your disclaimer or not?
Yeah, just what I said. Yeah, I tell people it's magic and psychology. My job's to blur the line, and that's all I touch upon it. And, you know, even after I say that, people still come up to me and they think, you know, I have super psychic powers. And, you know, I say, no, this is just entertainment. This is to give that experience of what mind reading could be.
Right.
Usually kind of, most people get it.
Right. Most people do.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, for an example, like what Banachek would use my five senses to create the illusion of a sixth sense.
Right, of course. Great line. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is a great line, certainly. And speaking of Banachek, I've worked with him so many times. And of course, as a business partner, but I was working for a client. I'd done 60 or 70 shows. And a time or two, we haven't been able to work things out. And they wanted me, and they couldn't change their date to affect my schedule. So I said, how about Banachek? Well, he just course, killed. And it was interesting because we were talking later and he said, well, this company had called me back because they were closing dinners for financial investors. And so said, well, they called me back and asked me to do a show for this. I mean, the client did. So I had called my client and they said, we're going to continue to use you. We love you. It's just that the top executives didn't understand how he was doing what he was doing.
Right.
It's a different brand. They were having fun with you. It's fun. It's funny. It's magic. And they know it's no magic. But when it comes to mind reading, they're thinking, what is this? How did he get in our minds or something? And they were curious to have another experience or another swing at the ball, I guess, you know. And so they were wanting to hire him to come back. And well, that's great. And I continue to say, well, you know, if there's others, you know, you want, don't feel like because you're not taking my client, you know, you're building on something else. And so I just think that mind reading has certainly an appeal, particularly in this case, it were people who were on the board of directors of different companies who, you know, use their minds all the time and they direct, you know, billion dollar companies and hundreds or thousands of personnel. And that somebody comes in and says and starts sweeping out your mind and dusting into the corners. And you're thinking, how'd they get in there?
Right. Yeah. And I think there is an intimacy with mentalism, right? So it has to be about that person and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I think the mistake, you know, people just getting to mentalism sometimes make is like, look at this power I have, and they make it about themselves when really it's about the audience member, the participant you're working with and how you make that human connection. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're seeing, you know, with the trend when I first started getting to mentalism, there was not a lot of mentalism, but now people are seeing the power that it has when you do make a connection. So you see a lot more magicians adding mentalism to their shows because, you know, they're getting this wow factor, this big, powerful moment. And I think, you know, magicians can learn that, like, even when you're doing traditional sleight of hand or just card tricks or whatever, to still try and find that connection and make it intimate or make it about the participant in some way. And I think you'll even get greater reactions than the reactions you're getting.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, I remember so clearly back in the 80s that it seems like Larry Becker was one of the people who was at the top of our field as far as being well known and everything. Because I remember going to Joe Stevens with Radio Magic, the Banachek was our first project back in 1987.
I remember the DVD, CD-ROM that the camera. Yeah.
Well, we had cassette tapes
before that.
And I remember talking to Joe about it, and he said, I can't market that for you because he said mentalism just doesn't sell. I remember it's like he's sitting here yesterday. It's just mentalism doesn't sell. And at that time, it didn't. It was one of these things that over the decades has obviously not just grown, but it's taken the world by storm. I mean, look at Darren Brown. I mean,
absolutely.
And others. I mean, not, I said, the dark country, but all over. Now, one of the things that Bob Cassidy used to tell me is about how to identify what your powers are.
Sure.
I mean, do you have the ability to bend metal? Are you, you know, psychokinetic? Or, I mean, are you, you know, the psychokinesis, or are you clairvoyant? You can't be bouncing all over the place. Have you thought about that, or do you try to present different kinds of things, or do you have a power per se?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways you can approach mentalism, whether it's from a psychic kind of perspective, like Bob would have his web where he would connect with people kind of through the psychic web theory. But because I decided early on that I was going to do this mix of magic and psychological approach, that I was going to keep all of my, quote, powers in that realm. So there's only two things I can really do, and everything else is just different ways of dressing it up. So you're either going to read people kind of like a poker player, you're reading their tells, or you're influencing them. So I'm not even predictions, I'm influencing you to say what I want you to say through, you know, the gestures and words that I'm using. So because I have that really defined, when I'm looking for material, you're not going to see me doing a PK routine, any metal bending, anything like that, because it doesn't fit with my skill set that I've kind of refined with how I'm approaching it.
Right, right. I was doing a show many years ago, and I remember after it was over that, and it was strictly just mentalism. I was trying something, not any magic at all or whatever. And I had structured the show very well, I thought, that flowed, and it did, and got good response. But afterwards, I was talking to a friend of mine, Jamie Salinas.
Yeah.
He was saying, it was just a series of predictions. It was like a different, you know, it was on a pad of paper, or it was inside of a book, or you mean, it was just, I must have had six different predictions. So I look back at that, it's like, yeah, well, maybe that was what my power was. I'm able to make predictions or something.
that is the hardest part about finding routines, is varying it up within a very limited skill set. I mean, like, again, you're kind of boxed in, but I love this idea. There's a book called A Beautiful Constraint, and it's all about creating art when you have some sort of specific rigid guideline. So because you're putting these self-imposed rules, it forces you to be more creative and find solutions with that fit within those boundaries. Mm-hmm. When often I get the most stuck, it's when I have no parameters at all and anything is open and all the options are possibilities, and you kind of get stuck with choice paralysis because you don't know which path to even go down.
Right.
And then you don't go down any. So once you just make a decision and go down that path, then you find ways that things are going to work out, and you'll find new approaches and new ways. So when I'm creating now, I'm constantly trying to find new ways, one, to make mentalism feel bigger or feel more visual, which is always hard to do because it's so internal. But also, I'm trying to find, you know, specific new paths, new reveals, things that are different. I'm looking to different types of art as inspiration, and not just of what other mentalists do, because if we look at what other performers do, we tend to recreate the wheel, or everyone starts to do the same type of material the same way. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what everyone's doing so I can do something different and I can be unique in that playing field amongst other performers.
Right.
Yeah.
It seems that, like, there are, what Fitzgibbon said, what are there, 15 different elemental things, you know, where there's transformation, transportation of something, a vanish, penetration, production.
Sure.
You know, there's a few things like that, I'm saying. And mentalism is one that's kind of all lumped together.
Exactly. But within mentalism, I think you can break it down in a few more ways. But again,
at least
it's more limiting.
Yeah. At least 13 steps.
Well, those are more about, I think, methods, but yeah.
But
that's the mentalism AA program. You get an extra step.
An extra step.
Yeah.
And then
to quit the mentalism.
Mentalism Anonymous.
Yeah,
Mentalist
exactly.
Anonymous. M.A. So, again, adding comedy, that is a whole different thing, and then trying to keep that so it's short and sweet, so you're not having a drawn-out routine. It was just, I guess, comparing this about when Doniger's perform, I'm sure, that they had some long, protracted types of routines, but that was of an age shortly after Houdini had done all of his things, where he would be on stage and trying to get out of a straitjacket, he'd be behind a curtain or something, and people would just stare at the curtain for 15 minutes. You can't do that now, obviously, but I mean, it was something back then, and I guess heart-stopping to, or whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, just in the technological age we're in, where, you know, you have TikTok and you have these short videos. I mean, I'm finding it even with myself, my own attention span is, you know, very limited. And I think we have to understand that about our audiences. Like, you can do long, drawn-out pieces as long as you keep it engaging along the way. People are willing to sit down and watch an hour long of quality TV right now, but, you know, they're also willing to just sit and watch a YouTube video that's a few minutes, long. So we have to have that variety and keep the audience engaged through what we're saying, make everything intentional, because if you're just filling the time with or not, you're meandering around, you're going to lose the audience. So you got to draw people in emotionally. You got to keep their attention, or keep things short and get to the point.
Right.
Those are the two strategies.
Get in, get out.
And I think they're both important in a show. I think you have to have variety. If you're looking at your, you know, whatever, whether you're doing a set as a close-up performer or a full stage show, have moments where you have a longer piece where you draw people in emotionally, or have some quick, fast fire, you know, bam, bam, bam routines. Mm-hmm. When I'm not performing and not on the road, I try every chance I get, because since I live in New York City, to go see a theater. And I think you just learn lessons from watching other people tell stories, or what people are being entertained and how they're being engaged, whether it's a Broadway show or a comedy show or some weird avant-garde circus thing. Yeah. Like, that's one of the reasons I love living in New York City, because you can go see a show every night and you can learn something of either what to do, or if it's not so good of a show, you can also learn the other thing of what not to do. So it can be a learning lesson.
One way or the other, that's
yeah.
true. Yeah. I remember seeing some people on stage saying, oh, now I know what not to do.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I've been inspired by some people on stage saying, oh, that could be also applied to this. I mean, but by going and seeing these kinds of things, it inspires you further, I guess, because obviously those are scripted and not just an outline. I think a lot of times magicians might have an outline of something. And so when they will rehearse or practice, there's a difference. But I think if they are rehearsing their script and talking, then they will start to get their timing down whenever that they actually in real life situation. So do you write your scripts then too?
Or? Yeah. I mean, I write things, a lot of stuff too. I mean, there's different ways to approach, you know, this from like even a stand-up performer will write some jokes down during the day, but right. they'll just have the basic idea and you can actually work things out on stage. But you also know you can have like works in progress shows. You know that the things aren't going to be as smooth as once you do it over 100 times. And then once you do it for over and over again, things get polished and that almost becomes your script because you start saying it the same way. So you can approach scripting that way, or you can try writing things out. I do it both ways back and forth all the time. But sometimes when you write out a perfect script, it doesn't really feel like you're saying it until you're on stage actually saying it. So you're still refining a perfectly written out script in the moment because you have to be paying attention to the audience. You have to pay attention to how it sounds in your own voice. You have to make adjustments so that it fits your personality, is more authentic to you.
And it needs to sound authentic and as opposed to scripted, because I remember listening to a guy one time who I talked after the show about this very subject. Mm-hmm. I said, it sounded like you were just reading a script because he was kind of monotonous and he didn't add any kind of nuances to his speech when he was talking. And I thought, this just sounds like a robot talking or something over here. And he said, well, it was a script I've just written. And it's in my head. And I rehearsed this a lot, but I hadn't rehearsed it, obviously, in front of an audience. And timing and misdirection are the two things you cannot practice until you actually have somebody to look at you and give you some kind of feedback, whether it's applause, laughter, or whatever.
Right. And if you're finding yourself in that trap where it sounds scripted, it just means you haven't then run it enough times, because eventually it should be in your bones. And that way, once you have that scripting down, then you shouldn't be doing that while you're still figuring out the magic, right? Because that's too much to keep in your head.
It is a lot.
So you need to have one of those down pat so you can focus on the other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you have your magic down pat, then that way you are, again, focusing more on the audience. And I like to compare, let's say, Lance Burton, when I remember seeing his Beautiful Dove act, he used to, well, which we won the FISM award for, and also the gold medal for the IBM back in the 70s. But the point is about how that he was not looking at his dove steals or even the dove itself. He was just looking at the audience. He just had that 10-yard stare, 10-mile stare, basically, looked like Dracula, kind of looking out into the audience without paying attention, kind of, I guess, like Channing Pollock had, you know, just kind of a nice style in which he's engaging the audience by looking at them and not at his hands or what the magic is happening, because you know so well what you're doing. Likewise with mentalism, you know where you're going and what you're doing. You may not have to worry about a double lift or a double undercut, or you're going to be doing a biddle count or whatever with anything, except maybe you're going to have some business cards or whatever you might happen to use. But I would think that it would be still that you have, I think, even more to think about as a mentalist that could go wrong, because you're walking a tightrope if you hope that a person responds to the question as you ask it. So therefore, your instructions, particularly for a mentalist, have to be very explicit, because if they go the wrong way, so could the routine.
Yeah, and that's all, you know, practice and figuring out the exact wording and, like, again, doing it over and over again.
Sure.
But, I mean, having a script is so important, because then when you can't, you know, you can divert from it.
Yeah.
And you can be present in the moment call out these, you know, elephants in the room that everyone's aware of.
Yeah.
And then you can know you can always come back to the script. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of my pet peeves is if I see a performer in something that clearly the whole audience is aware of, like something if a server dropped a tray and everyone's head, you know, turns that way. If you don't like acknowledge or at least be present in the moment, and you just steam forward, that's also going to be weird to the audience. So, you know, just be with them, be in the moment, you know, acknowledge where you are, what the venue is. I mean, a good comedy exercise is like, get to the room. It's like, what are the common ground? What is the audience already thinking about where they are? And how do we address that at the top so that there's no open question marks metaphorically hanging above the stage? Because if there's any unanswered questions that you're not addressing in within the first couple of minutes, the audience is going to be paying attention to this invisible question mark hanging above the stage rather than paying attention to you.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And that's another improv lesson, because you set up the who, what, where of a scene first. Mm-hmm. So if you don't get that out of the way, people are wondering, who are these people? Where are they? So you want to address that so that then people can just focus and get on board as soon as possible.
With my routine, one of the first things I say, well, come out. I'm like Santa Claus. I say, ho, ho, ho. And I say a couple things. And I say, well, you know, you're probably wondering, what is an overweight, white, bearded fat man doing here this time of the year? And
that's a classic of being aware of who you are and what you're presenting. Right. There was a great exercise I did through the Annoyance Theater. Had us, each student step forward, and they just let everyone in the audience shout out characters
that
they would
like.
Play in a movie or something. So like, obviously me, I got a lot of like techie, nerdy best friend kind of stuff, but it's stuff that I'm already aware of, right?
Yeah.
So you, knowing what you're presenting just by walking on stage is so valuable, because then you can either play into that expectation or you can subvert that expectation. You can find comedy in going against type as well. So,
well, yeah. I remember talking to Jason Alexander, who was famously on Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And he was talking with his agent early on, and his agent was always booking him for those kinds of roles that might be, they think, suitable for him. But he wanted to play like as a starring leading man role. And they said, you'll never be that. You know, you're going to be, if you're going to be a leading man, it's going to be Falstaff, you know, in a Shakespeare play or something, kind of a rotund and funny kind of a guy. As Costanza, obviously, he, you know, hit it on the, and it's been a character. Sometimes you look at somebody, let's say Bob Sheets, he has a unique look that it's just funny to look at him when he smiles, and you know, and he plays a jester, and it's not a far reach to start laughing at some people, or that they have I think that Alex Boyce has a really clean and elegant look, and he looks and he plays the part, and he's got the right kind of music and everything. Once you recognize who your character is, then the audience kind of can buy into that easier.
Right.
As you said, I think you're recognizing the elephant in the room, but yeah, it has to be the what and where.
Yeah, and you can play into that, like I said, or like imagine with Jason Alexander, him casting a leading role in a romantic, you know, then there's a lot of comedy that can come from that.
That's
as well.
True too.
So
true
it's too. Just making that, you have to be aware of it in order to make the decision to either go
that's
with it or without, you know, so you go in one direction or the opposite, but you do have to make that choice. And in order to make that choice, you need to know what already there.
Well, talking about choices, I want to go back then to AGT and whenever you started preparing for that. What made you think that you wanted to get on? I mean, were friends saying, oh, you're really good, or you're funny, or you are a great mentalist, or how?
Yeah, I'm sure I've told the story if you've heard me on any podcast, or even back when. I think we talked way back when.
Yeah.
For me, it was just kind of scraping by. I'd originally just changed career path. I was going to go down this entertainment road and try it out. And I realized, you know, especially in the markets I was doing at the time, the college market, I was like, well, everyone seems to have a TV credit or some sort of thing to make them stand out. So I was like, I guess I'll try and get a TV credit. And not, you know, at least I have that experience to see what auditioning for a TV show is like.
Right.
And I expected nothing to come from it. And then the fact that, you know, it went over well with the producers, and, you know, I didn't tell anyone I was even auditioning. That's how little I felt about, you know.
Yeah, this is going nowhere.
Yeah, it's going nowhere. I didn't want even know people to know either way if it went good or bad.
Okay.
So, so I just thought nothing of it. I was like, all right, I got that experience to see what an audition's like. We'll just move on and see what the next opportunity is. And that's when they called me and they're like, hey, you're going to be on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So, once my first episode aired, I was happy because that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
I just wanted the clip. So the fact that I kept going beyond that, everything else after that was icing on the cake. So it's just, how do you keep that, you know, plate spinning as long as possible,
right,
get that attention going and coming up with new routines. And again, what plays big, what's visual, what hasn't been seen before. And that was all kind of the process of, you know, figuring out what to do on TV.
Well, that's the thing is, after the first week, it's like, what? They want me to come back and I got a week to figure out something. So did you go with the thought that I have two or three things, I guess I could do this. And then you start rehearsing. Rehearsing that, or, and then you had to run that by the producer, and they said yes or no, or
I had the luxury at the time being the first mentalist that they didn't ever see what anyone else could do, right?
Okay. So no comparison.
So I literally only pitched one thing per round. So they had to say yes because they didn't know. Like if you're a singer-songwriter, you have to give five songs as an option. And I always told people, like, don't pitch anything you don't want to do because odds are they're going to pick the one you want to do least. You know, if you choose something you don't want to do, it just happenstance they'll pick that
one. I never thought about that because I hear several times when someone will get started, then Simon Cowell will say, wait a minute, stop right there. I don't like such and such. Have you got anything else for us?
Yeah, maybe.
And I thought, boy, you know, first of all, that's, you know, taking you back. But then I'm thinking, no, I'm sorry, I don't have anything. You know, maybe I'll come back next week. Like, you know, but like a magician would not have something in his pocket necessarily because you're prepared for this.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, again, it's a whole different show now. I mean, it's a whole new judges, new hosts, new, you know, probably producers and everything.
Yeah, you had Howard Stern and Sharon.
Howie's still on the show. He's the one remaining constant. Yeah. But like for me, again, I was only going in with that one goal. So I, you know, I pitched doing, you know, duct tape over my eyes, the blindfold routine. But that was all I had planned ahead of time. And then I didn't start thinking about the next round until I found out that I was through to the next round.
Right.
So then I had a certain amount of time to figure out and pitch a new idea.
Right.
And then I also, again, we talked about, you know, putting a show together and having variety and ups and downs and longer pieces or shorter pieces. So I kind of started to treat my time on America's Got Talent as a whole as well. So, you know, I did a big piece using all three judges for the first round. And then the next piece, I brought it much smaller and, you know, revealed Sharon Osbourne's first crush. And I wanted, you know, not a negative comment, but a constructive comment so they can see I had room to grow. Because I then, if I went through to the live rounds, which I did, I was already planning on kind of starting to think what could be bigger. And I pitched this big deal or no deal thing. So now, when, you know, dance acts were on the show, they would kind of do an amazing number, but then do another amazing number that was equally as good. And they kind of just plateaued and it was just the same across each time they performed.
Yeah.
So I had, you know, peaks where I could keep building each time. And and so I do like, oh, it's small, it's intimate, this crush thing. But then bam, you got now 16 girls holding briefcases on stage, real big production value.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is what I've heard Simon often say, this is like to Matt Franco, this is great, but you need to play to the whole audience. Which is another great
thing. They loved Matt from the beginning. I mean, he took cards. He was very much in that lane. And then, you know, he found ways to make card tricks bigger and bigger. And, you know, using fire or things showing up in, you know, the seats of
Right.
of Radio City Music Hall. So,
so he still does in this show now.
I mean, it's amazing. It's all
He's got a great show. And
it's
what I'm
fantastic.
Thinking is that many years ago that he had won and he's able to, he's no longer, I think, riding the AGT wave.
He's coming to his own as, you know, he's
a legitimate star.
Yeah, I would say he has filled the void Lance kind of left behind as like the family show. You know, you're going to have a good time. And, you know, Matt's really, you know, that wow factor, but, you know, hey, you know, you can see Penn and Teller and they're doing, you know, all their amazing stuff. They've been around for a long time. You can see their greatest hits. You can see their new stuff. You can see Copperfield. You can see, you know, Chris Angel, all these big headliners on the strip, but Matt's that one that's like, he's the family show you want to bring the young kids to, the old, you know, the grandmas to, you know, and he's wowing them all. So yeah, super proud of my friend Matt.
Yeah.
And I've told him we had our own podcast that we started during the pandemic.
I do remember that, the two of you.
Yeah.
And I listened to every one of them.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I really did because I thought you had a nice vibe between the two of you. And you all, you were saying, well, you were going out and here are the shows I was doing and here's my experience. And he was talking about what he was doing. And of course, you were more going out. But, I mean, you were Zooming to the shows, I guess.
It was great to document that weird time during the pandemic while he was reopening his show in Vegas and I was going back on the road and the challenges we faced. I mean, I think I even posted on our social media of me like wearing, you know, those masks we wore, the big like shields.
Right.
You know? I look like a Mandalorian character going on the planes and performing behind plexiglass at, you know, colleges. Like I was a human zoo subject. You know, kind of stuff like that. So it was great to document that. And I mean, it was a good excuse for me and Matt to kind of, while we had the free time, to reconnect each week and you know, see where we were and talk magic theory. So the episodes are still up. I mean, we're no longer doing the podcast. We stopped, like, you know, when Matt had his baby. Right. Baby is the number one killer of podcasts. So don't have any babe nor babies soon. No, yeah. Scott. This one might end.
Thank you. Well, I think it's safe.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a great experience. I mean, I'm glad we have that kind of back catalog for people to discover.
Well, you can also tell what close friends you are.
I think that was the key to that.
And also the way that it flowed, because I remember there was like a fun little part where you play the game.
Yes. Of, diddle me this.
Riddle me, yeah.
Diddle me this.
Diddle me this.
The riddles, yes. Yes, yes. So I'm such a big trivia fan. So Matt started asking me trivia and I would ask him riddles and just to kind of break things up.
Did you really know the answer or not? I mean, there's just, did he come up with something each week that tried to fool you?
He would really try and trick me. That was all honest. Nothing was pre-planned.
I didn't think it was. It didn't feel like it was.
Yeah, because I've been such a trivia buff and I think it's important even as a mentalist.
You watched Jeopardy?
Yes. I tried out for Jeopardy once.
Did you?
Yeah.
And?
It was back in college. They don't tell you how many you missed on the quiz. Oh. This was in person too. Oh,
okay.
So I got like a water bottle and a pen. So and none of my categories came up too. So I said, I missed it by one. Who's going to know? I don't know.
Exactly. Don't know. You were that close.
But you can see me on Cash Cab. So I was on Cash Cab.
And did you make any money on that?
Yeah, me and my brother made a lot of money on that.
Now, as I recall on Cash Cab, that was kind of a short-lived trivia show.
Yeah.
Was that like in Vegas or where were they driving?
No, it was
around?
In New York.
It was in the city.
Okay. Yeah. And it was funny because they surprise you. And
explain the premise for people from other countries.
Yeah, it's an older show. It's not on anymore. But basically, you get in a cab and you tell them your destination, and then it's surprise, you're on a game show, the lights go off in the cab, and then you have until your destination to answer trivia questions for money, and then you got these like lifelines you can shout out to people if you're stuck like on the street and passersby can help you out. But yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that show. But it also, like, me and my brother are big trivia nerds, we always have been. I mean, he's a movie expert, he knows everything about movies, so like with my general knowledge and his movie expertise, we did pretty well. But to tie this back to magic, and especially mentalism, Matt and I talked about this on our podcast too, that the trivia, you know, knowing a little about a lot of things are just extra reference points you have when you're performing and someone says, you know, a thought, or if they say a movie and you happen to know something about that movie, now you know you can respond or you can extrapolate ideas from it. So like if I knew you were thinking of the movie Jurassic Park, you know, I'm probably going to reference the most iconic scene that comes to mind right away. If I tell you to think of an iconic scene, you're thinking of it right now, Scott.
Yeah. I'm
probably picturing in the same exact one. So I'm probably picturing, oh, I'm getting a lot of rain. I'm getting like maybe the fence is getting broken, the giant T-Rex is coming over, it's attacking the cars and the mud. So I'm adding all these extra details to a thought that we just are sharing shared experiences before we even name the movie. Or even if we do name the movie, the fact that you're thinking of that same scene, I can make it feel like, you know, I picked up on your thought when I'm just pulling from my own trivia knowledge of something. So the more you can know about things in the world, the more you can make those references and you know, make that mind reading feel even more
real. I always
real.
Like that about particularly a movie trivia and a movie prediction, in which that there are a bunch of movies, and once that you know what it's going to be, that you are saying, well, I'm getting this because there was something burning, or I'm getting the sense or smell of smoke or whatever it is. And you describe a scene from the movie, and it may or may not be this, like you were more direct and saying, here's what you're thinking of, but you're saying, does this make sense to you? You know, the smoke or the fire or something, and it was in a city, and it was, I want to say it was in the South someplace, and this is an older movie.
And even if they're not thinking that, now they're trying to make sense of what you're getting.
Correct.
So now it seems like you're reading their mind either way. But you can't do that stuff if you've never seen the movie. So, I mean, you have to, like, the more you know, there's another lesson from improv. It's like you never know what situation you're going to be in a scene. So if you know, do a little homework, like figure out what, like, a postal worker does, you know, so that you can draw from that experience. You don't need to know it as an expert, but just have a couple reference points. And, you know, you can use that in your Rolodex and just pull it out. You know, know, when you're live performing.
One of the most incredible things, one of my friend Dave McGee does, is people will write down, they'll think of a celebrity, and they'll just write down their first and last initial, and then he'll get a peek at it. So he supposedly doesn't even know their initials. So he said, I want you to think of the person, jot down their initials is all you have to do. And he could tell from the initials 90% of the time. He was telling me he was doing a show like for Al Pacino, and he was just, and it had some other celebrities that he's performed for. To me, that's the most amazing thing. And I've tried that a time or two, and I haven't
It's tough. I mean, even not in the magic world, I show off my brother who does a trick, and it's not a magic trick. Like I said, it's just he can do 6 degrees of
just Kevin. A skill.
He can do 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon between any two actors. Again, he's just making those he goes off into the corner and he kind of thinks through the movies and different movies
people. He can say Sharon Stone and Jeff Bridges and
put them on the spot, and then he can then tell you how they're connected and what movies they're connected through. And it feels like a magic trick, even though it's just trivia.
That is incredible. But it's just a skill.
Yeah,
that some people have because of the knowledge that what you have.
Yep.
Man.
So use everything. That's the other thing I learned about showbiz. I mean, I think Johnny Carson wrote about this too. He's like, you're going to use everything you know as like a late night host. You're going to use everything, every bit of you, it comes back. So, you know, that's what I want to see when I see a performer is like, what parts of their lives are they sharing? And I want them to use as much as possible because, again, it goes back to being unique, and that makes you different than everyone else, of the more experiences you can share that you've had.
That's like with my podcast. Whenever I'm talking to people, I have lived long enough and done enough things that I can relate to different kinds of sequences that people, their trails might go down, because I can relate to that and kind of help talk about that.
Absolutely.
Then as well. Yeah. And speaking of podcasts, the name of your podcast was again, what?
We were Mind Over Magic.
Mind Over Magic.
So you could check that out. Yeah. The archives.
What would be one of the ones that you would recommend? In other words, people have asked me, well, if I've never listened to the podcast, what one would you recommend that would hook me to listening to the others? Was there something that you guys did once? It was because you never had guests. It was just the two of you.
We had like two guests over 100 episodes or something like that. So they were very rare to have guests. I can't think of which one off the top, but just kind of read through the descriptions.
They were
find
always
one.
A lot of fun, and they were all I say the same. I mean, as far as the structure of it.
Sure. But we'd go into theory. We always save like the heavy theory for the second half. We'd kind of catch up a little bit, see where we were in the world for the first half. We'd break it up with a little like the trivia and the riddle, and then we'd kind of go into different deep theory ideas, whether it's performing based or magic theory as well. So that was always kind of our format, but you know, it was very much top of mind. And again, the connection me and Matt, I think, was the unique part, to see you know, that we just had so many years as friends together. We know kind of how to lead and play off of each other's thoughts and
how
see
many episodes
where we align.
Did you do?
I think we did about 100. I think we did it for 2 years.
Well, that is still quite a few, because that puts you in a very high percentile of most podcasts, because most don't go past a dozen.
It's all about that consistency, and we were trying to release it each week at a certain time.
Right. Well, particularly we got two guys who are super busy, of trying to get together. I think that was kind of the demise of Shazam that was with Kayla Drescher and Carissa Hendricks. And as Carissa became Lucy Darling, and they both had their kind of careers, and they just didn't have time to get together and talk. And so they tried to do them separately, and it just didn't have the same chemistry, I guess.
I can speak from experience with like the indie improv teams I was doing in New York way back when. Now you're trying to coordinate 8 people's schedules, so having a consistent improv team practice each week and then find performances, they don't last long sometimes.
Yes, I understand. Well, we could go on for much longer. I appreciate the time that you've given me over here.
This
has been fantastic.
Great, Scott.
A lot
I'm
of fun.
We were finally able
catching
to
up.
Connect more than just in passing in the hallway.
This is a good quality conversation.
Absolutely.
That's what I miss about some conventions like this that are too large. You don't have time to really sit down. I like these opportunities to get a chance to sit down. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I always close by asking my guests, what it is that's your philosophy of life? What do you live by?
That's a deep one, Scott, right away. A philosophy of life. I mean, I think at this moment, to maybe just sum up what we've been talking about, is kind of like find that authentic you and, bring all of you to everything you do, because that's what sets you apart. And, you know, what are we doing, whether not to the, you know, we're going to see shows to see someone on stage bearing right. themselves on stage for your enjoyment, you know. Mm-hmm. People go to theater just as an excuse to stare at another human being. So, mm-hmm. like, find out who you are so you can make a better connection with someone else, I think.
That was well said. Boy, I'm glad I have that on record or recorded so I go back and say that again.
Yeah.
Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
I appreciate you coming here. Thanks for your friendship and time.
Can I plug just like,
oh, if please
you
want do.
To, yeah, go to my website, ericdittleman.com. You can spell it wrong. It'll probably still get there, but it is ericdittleman.com. And then just every social media is E Dittleman, spelled the same way, Dittleman. So
if you're in the city, be sure and go by Speakeasy.
Yeah. And I might be there.
That's right. And if they need to contact you, they can, saying, hey, what is your schedule? So that way I might be able to
hopefully we can coordinate.
Check you out when you're going to be there. Great. Eric, thanks again.
Thanks for having
me. Appreciate it. You bet. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Dittleman. Scotty out.
Thank you, Eric. That was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed spending some time with you, and I look forward to our next visit. I hope you, the listener, got a lot out of that as well. In fact, I kind of feel like he had so much information there, you might want to go back and listen to it yet again or a third time, perhaps, and make sure that you share these podcasts with your other friends so this way that we can help increase our listenership at the Magic Word Podcast and help this podcast grow. We have a great lineup of guests during October that I know you're going to enjoy as we get more into this month of Boo. So until next week, stay well. Get booked, and remember to find out who you are so you can make a better connection with someone else. This is Scotty out.